You're listening to the Mako Minute, the 482nd Fighter Wing podcast. In this episode, Colonel Kelly introduces us to our new command chief and then interviews the former deputy wing commander, newly retired Colonel Craig Simmons. Let's head on over to Custer's Corner.
All right, here we go. I think this is the third installment of Custer's Corner. I'm not solo today, which is awesome. Got Chief Kerry Contreras here, and we've also got Colonel Craig Simmons, RIP, which we'll talk to here real soon in depth about a few things. In that realm, I always go back and listen to these things. So today I'm going to try to sound like I didn't just run a marathon because the last one I was breathing heavily. I don't know what that was. Maybe it's just fear, but we'll get there. Real quick, this time, not a whole lot of updates for the wing. Just keep listening to your commanders, leadership, shop chiefs. What I will bring you up to date on is November. We will have the UTA, of course, first and second, but then kicking off November 3rd will be the large force combat readiness exercise inspection and UEI. A lot of us will head up to Dobbins Air Reserve Base with the air staff, combat control, and the cabs. And then the MGFE will hang out down here, fly the mission, do the thing, and go up to Avon Park as well. That sets the foundation for where we head in January. The last week of January, about 26 Jan, we head out to Nellis for Red Flag 1 for 2 weeks. From there, the MGFE and the MSTs will stay an extra week for Bamboo Eagle. And they sounds like they may head out with their 12-ship to March Air Reserve Base to operate Bamboo Eagle, while we as a C2 and cabs will probably go to Fort Irwin and do some things out in the backside of the desert with the command and control cabs again. And we may have a active duty rescue wing as an MGFE attached to us as well. With that, pay attention to the next few UTAs. There's a lot of training we got to get done. Expect some of it for our full-timers during the week with sea burning, things of that nature. That's really quick updates from Custer, other than officially introducing Chief Master Sergeant Kerry Contreras, not new to the wing, but new back to us in this role. She most recently coming from the 944th Fighter Wing out at Luke Air Force Base as their command chief. So, Kerry, you want to say hello?
Hello, everybody. Yeah, so happy to be back. Before I left here 2 years ago, I was at the group level at the maintenance group. Had an opportunity to fill in at the wing for about 90 days and successfully did not burn it down. So I guess I get a second shot here and looking forward to it. And Colonel Simmons has given me the questionable wave here as he was here as well when I was here. But happy to be back and looking forward to meeting everybody. I would prefer and hope that in the coming months I get some time at the unit level vice a massive wing commander's call just to get to know everybody in the operation a little bit more intimately.
Yeah, we're absolutely thrilled to have her back. I'm thrilled to get to work with her as she's already keeping me in line, and she's definitely got the pulse of the airman, so that's going to be awesome. That's all I got for Custer's Corner, so Custer's out. All right, here we are rejoined back with Colonel Craig Rip Simmons, Fighter Wing Deputy Commander Extraordinaire, all things in there. The reason I want to do this, as you've already seen the previous couple of podcasts we've done, is talking to some great people in the wing with way more to come. But with Rip heading out here into other bigger and better things, I wanted you guys, even though he is leaving, to hear a little more of his story, where he's from, why he is, the way he is, and what he's done, not only for us, for this wing, for you, for the country and his family. Rip, welcome to the mic. Glad you, I'm not going to say willingly came in here, but thanks for showing up.
Happy to be here.
With that, let's get to know you a little bit. Who are you? Where are you from? What made you who you are?
I was born and raised in Mississippi. I'm the oldest of four siblings. My mom and dad still live on the same farm I grew up on back in Mississippi. I developed my love of flying, believe it or not, while farming the land at my mom and dad's. There's a low-level training route that flies that goes right over my mom and dad's farm. And back in the day, F-4s were still something that was prevalent. I'm pretty sure there were no restrictions on how low you could fly back then because they came over treetop level.
At least they proved it, right?
Exactly. But they would scare the hell out of you. You'd be sitting there on the tractor, and they're so loud. And you knew they traveled in fours. The first pair would come over, and then now you're just waiting for the second pair to come over. And then the Challenger disaster, I was in seventh grade at the time. I just thought those folks were heroes and wanted to be an astronaut. So I started researching, how do I get to that point? And I had some great mentors, lots of folks that backed me up in my dream. The biggest were my parents, mostly my mom. My mom knew that I wanted to get out of the farm and go do something else. And she knew that I had a fire in me to go do that. At seventh grade, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Started figuring out how to be an astronaut, and test pilot school was the way to go. And how to get to test pilot school, we go to academy and be a fighter pilot. So that started the journey. And my mom helped me out. Back then, there was no internet, so we had to use snail mail to call the academy or mail the academy or make phone calls to figure out how to get there. And then my first year out of high school, I did not get in the academy, so I went to your junior college, and then I got in the second.
And with that, real quick, sorry to jump in. So you didn't make it the first time, right? So there's probably something in family, maybe your mom, that or folks or quality of life that you didn't quit.
No,
so where'd that come from?
I'll tell you what. I went to Forest County Agricultural High School in Mississippi. We have about 300 acres at that school, a lot of agriculture classes and whatnot. We only had two AP courses. One was history and one was English. The highest math we had there was just advanced math. We didn't even have calculus. I think that held me back a little bit. My high school counselor, Dr. Blue, when I went into her my junior and senior year to talk about where I wanted to go to college, I told her I wanted to get Air Force Academy, and she says, I think you need to be a little bit more realistic. Wow. Yeah. I was like, fights on.
Yeah. Let me prove you wrong here.
If I still had her contact info, I'd probably send her an invite to my retirement.
That'd be awesome.
But after that, I didn't give up because it was something I wanted to do really badly. And believe it or not, I got denied a second time. I was going through a hefty four classes at Pool River Community College at the time. I was taking two chemistries, physics, and calculus in order to get ready for the academy. And I was coming home. I was staying at home. It's about a 45-minute drive to the college. And I was going with a buddy of mine. And we were both still living at home. And my mom came outside and met us outside. And she goes, I don't know what I'm going to do with you. You've really done it this time. And I'm looking over at my friend Chris. I'm like,
she found out.
Oh, boy. And she says, you're going to the Air Force Academy. And then evidently we got a letter in the mail. I was a first alternate and someone decided they didn't want to go. And I stepped in. And that was a feeling of complete elation followed by a feeling of complete panic. Because at that point, I only had a month until I was going to go to basic training.
So elation and panic. Let's hold on to that theme because I bet it'll follow you throughout your career, I bet.
Sure, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Ended up at the Air Force Academy. And then when I graduated there, I graduated a degree in engineering mechanics. And then I worked at the astronautics department there at the academy for about 9 months. That was pretty cool. And then ended up going to pilot training at Columbus Air Force Base. And the rest is history.
Yeah, history. You got a lot of it because you're old.
Older than you.
Older. Yeah, we call that experience, Carrie.
We do.
With that, you talk about fear, elation, and panic in that realm. We'll jump into that here with Ken. So for the crowd, this is not rehearsed, as you can tell. So we're just taking as we go here. In that realm, elation and panic, you got a few kids?
Yeah, but I've got three or four of my own, and I inherited three through getting married to my wife. So we got a total of seven kids, one together, three each.
Copy, elation and panic. Got it. Tell me one thing that you try to pass on to your kids.
Be a good human.
Be a good human.
Yeah, and that's a huge... There's a lot that goes into being a good human, right? One of the things I instill in my kids is I will not tolerate breaks in integrity. You're way better off if you screwed up and you come tell me. We can work with you. Otherwise, if you try to hide it or just straight out lie to me, then your punishment's going to be a lot worse. And in that, a lot of my kids come to me instead of my wife. Well, even my stepkids are like, hey, Craig, I need to talk to you. Let's talk it out. So,
yeah, I tell you, I'm a little brother, so I haven't been perfect in that. But I was told by my wife that if you always tell the truth, you never have to remember what you say.
That is very wise words.
Yes, I fail daily on that one sometimes, it appears. So, went to the zoo, the academy, Columbus Air Force Base. I was there as well. 0101, you're probably a minute before that.
9808,
cool. Was the Viper the first on your dream sheet?
No, it was not. My first choice was Eagles at the time, actually. But thank God that didn't happen.
Divine intervention.
Yeah. I put a lot of pressure on myself in pilot training. And in complete honestly, I was horrible at check rides. Really good stick in the jet. And then I put way too much pressure on myself and check rides. because I knew that pilot training's weighted, and they cut a line, and everybody above that line is going to go fight a bomber track, and everybody else is going to go to T1s. Even when I got to T38, so I just put too much pressure on myself. In fact, it was one guy in front of me, because at the time, what they did was between Vance, Laughlin, and Columbus, we would rotate. We'd be in a big telecon, and they would have a huge Excel spreadsheet with all the jets up there, A-10s, 15Es, B-1s, B-52s. And I was doing the math, and I knew where I was in the mix, and I was going to end up with a bomber. Someone at Vance wanted to go B-1s. I'll tell you what, my entire class knew as well. And whenever that person picked a B1 advance, the entire club, you couldn't hear. It was like.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was cool. And then when I chose next, I was like, I want an F-16. So.
At least you're a small guy.
Yeah,
you fit right in this thing.
I motored the seat all the way down, and I'm looking over the HUD still. I've got to squish down a little bit.
Yeah, everyone knows when they get in a jet after you. That's no doubt. You talk about too much pressure. So let's jump ahead. 20, 25 years. You can pass something on to our airmen. There's a lot going on in the wing, of course. A lot of pressure, a lot of stress. Let's give us a little insight into too much pressure. Good thing, bad thing, keep you on your toes or not.
I'll tell you what, I will tell you right now that every time you go into something new, even as a commander, I was the deck commander down at Shaw. Whenever you sit in the seat, you're on G-Series orders, there's no shit moment. Ooh. Buck stops with me. But the thing is that when you go into an organization and you're in charge, you just got to walk in humble, realize that you have a lot of folks that work for you that are incredible. You have a lot of subject matter experts to lean on. So it's not important for you to know everything. It's important for you to walk into a room, be humble, be open to suggestions, gather the data, in the time you have allotted, then make a decision and then execute. There's no need to be paralyzed. When you walk in, everyone knows you're new. Everyone knows that you don't know everything. Just go with that. I think you get a lot of street cred when you walk into a room and say, you know what? I don't know everything. That's why you guys get paid. What you get paid is to help me out along the way.
And for our airmen, you know that now. Did you know it 25 years ago?
No, go all the way back to the academy. I knew I struggled in school I did not struggle in high school. I did not have to study. And my daughter, 17-year-old, who's where we'd be now, she's wise beyond her years because she has a classmate that doesn't have to study and he makes straight A's. She studies her butt off, makes straight A's. She goes, but you know what? When I get to college, I'm going to do fine. He's not. And I was like, all right. Yeah, you're right. You're 100%. Because I was that guy that struggled because I did not have to study in high school.
I didn't study in high school. I went to two different colleges. The scholarship didn't end with me that I started, and I definitely ended with a different major than I started.
To go.
Yeah, path of least resistance sometimes.
But going back to that fear or uncertainty, every time, it may be a little different for us fighter pilots because when we show up to a squadron, it's automatically, you've got brothers and sisters there. But in the same breath, you want to have credibility. You want to be approachable. You want to be a good instructor. But again, if you're humble and you go in, and especially in a brief, like if a wingman says, what do I have to do here to get to this mode and the MFD to change this weapon setting? I'm not going to BS somebody. It's like, yeah, you got to do this and this. No, I was like, I don't know, but we'll look that up when we get back. And if you take him by the hand, him or her, and let's go back to weapons, and you start flipping through docs or on the computer now, they'll appreciate it.
For the crowd, yeah, learned that years ago as well. And it's, you can take that to any subject in your shop, your life. I don't know, but let's go find those who do and let's work it out together. Yep. And that's where we'll get there. Back to pilot training, got the Viper. Where'd you go through a schoolhouse out, Luke? Or?
Yeah, I went to Luke Air Force Base. I was in the 62nd. And it's funny, is I barely made it through pilot training into fighters. And when I got to Luke, the pressure was off because I've got my F-16, it's fine. And I absolutely had a blast flying out there. I was a distinguished graduate. So I went from the bottom of my T-38 class to distinguished graduate out of Luke. And it was largely due not to just skill. Every fighter pilot's got to have some skill. But the quality of folks that we had in our pilot training class, we had so many smart and talented folks in our class. And we always studied together. We always picked each other up when we were down. But yeah, F-16 training was, it was fun. It was an absolute blast. You won't, a lot of people you won't hear that from, that RTU was a fun gig, but it was a good time. And I got my first choice of assignment, Shaw Air Force Base, out of there. And then I showed up at Shaw Air Force Base in April of 99, I believe.
April 99. Awesome. A couple things about to go on in the world after that. For the crowd, you can go out and grab his bio and see everywhere he's been, Regaf, things like that. And I want to hit on a few top ones here in his career. And he will take us down this path that he wants. Rip and I didn't know it, but we met each other through the radio, I think, back in 2003. We're both playing in the sand in Iraq in different areas on the ground. So I want to hit that one a little bit. So for the crowd, take us to how you got to that point and then what that job was and then maybe some things there that we don't know about you.
Sure. So my first assignment at Shaw, I was in a group of lieutenants. Lo and behold, Kangaroo, he's not going to be at my retirement, but he's in a group of punks that we still have a WhatsApp thread. We always try to get back together again. And our old DO, Kangaroo. And he admitted after the fact that he was the only DO at Shaw that would call back to the schoolhouse to all of the other DOs and go, hey, who's your top guy? Who's blah, blah, blah. So he completely stacked the deck at in the shooters, the 55th Fighter Squadron, back in, I would say, 99 to 02.
So, break. Quick lesson learned for your airmen, your flight chiefs, and the other folks out there. Call who you know and use it to your advantage, right?
Correct.
Stack the deck. I don't ever want to fight a fair fight. I want to stack the deck. So, good on him.
So, you had a squadron full of lieutenants that were all distinguished graduates out of college.
Wow.
And it was good and bad because we're all good, but there are only so many slots to upgrade to flight lead and instructor pilot. So, we've been spread out across the wing. Things might have happened different for me, but there were a few guys that were in front of me for instructor pilot upgrade, and include to the point where it was time for me to PCS, and I was on the VML, and my squadron commander went to my group commander and says, I want to reclama this guy so I can put him in the instructor pilot upgrade. And Panga brought me into his office because he said, I want to do this for you. Are you cool with it? And I'm like, absolutely, man. That means I might get to go to weapons school. And so the OG wanted to talk to me. I went and interviewed with the OG, and he goes, absolutely, we'll keep him back. And then 9/11 happened, and then about, actually, no, 9/11 did not happen yet. A month after that conversation with Kanga, you could tell he's distraught a little bit, having some issues with what he wanted to talk to. He goes, hey, dude, I want you to come into my office and shut the door. That's never good, right? Your DO calls you into his office and says, shut the door. And I'm like, thinking back to, was it airspace? Did I go supersonic where I wasn't supposed to? You know, all the things you're thinking of as a pilot. And he goes, hey, dude, there is a pop-up on the VML for an air liaison tour to Fort Drumney. And you are the only one qualified in the entire.
Good old Watertown, New York. I know you'll get to that in a second. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, what's that got to do with me, man? He goes, dude, you got to go. And I was like, crushed. That was the death knell for weapons school. It was not going to happen now. I was going to come back. I was going to be too old. It's going to be 2 years out of the jet, maybe three. It was going to take me a while to get back up on step. So I had to eternalize that and process it on my own and with bros, maybe with a lot of whiskey. And I finally came to terms with it when I was sitting at AGOS at Nellis Air Force Base, which is Air Ground Operations School, getting ready to go learn how to be a JTAC and an air liaison officer. And I'm sitting there watching the TV. 9/11 had happened by then, and I'm going to be a part of the 10th Mountain, and I'm watching the 10th Mountain go into Afghanistan. So I was like, this might actually be fun. So I ended up at Fort Drum, New York. I had a great flight commander. I was an assistant flight commander because I was a very young captain at the time. And Pinball Violet, she was an F-15E Wizzo. She actually, when she retired, she was the commander of the Air-to-Ground Operations School at Nellis as a colonel. Awesome chick, man. Great person to work for. But we had one office. We were in an old condemned barracks on Fort Drum, New York.
The old green one?
I think so. It was two stories.
That's where the circle comes around. I was assigned later we'll talk about as a JTAC of ALO with the 10th Mountain and the 20th ASOS as there well. For the crowd, you can go Google what an ALO is, but it's a full, about a three-year tour where an Air Force pilot goes and lives with the Army at their installation, does the things with them. He's the air control expert for that organization at different levels, and he'll have enlisted folks, JTACs, but he becomes a fully qualified, probably a ground FAC at that time. That's how old you are. Me too. And then we became joint terminal air controllers in that realm. So that's the quick and dirty on that one, but jump back in, Rip.
I get there, I'm assistant flight commander. I think I was getting on pinball's nerves because we had the same office. It's about half the size of yours. She goes, dude, I got all the admin stuff. Why don't you just go hang out with the airmen, with the TACPs, and figure out what it is to be a TAC? And I was like, okay, I'll do that. I walked over to the next building, which was supply. It's okay, Captain Simmons here, brand new. I need gear. And the master sergeant looks at me and goes, when did you get here? I'm like, oh, 5 days ago, 4 days ago. He's all right. So he just starts going back to the back and pulling stuff out. Body armor, freaking magazines for weapons, all kinds of stuff. I walked out of there with two duffel bags and still had to go back and put stuff in my truck. And then the guys were getting ready downstairs to go out in the field. They were going to do some small team tactics. They were going to take an 8-man team with aggressors, E&E through the swamps of Fort Drum, New York, about 2.5 miles into an OP, try to direct air against a target with live A-10s and then egress without getting detected by the red guys. And I was like, hey, can I tag along? And they were like, oh, dude, this is kind of like a competition type thing. And I was like, dude, I was born and raised in South Mississippi. I love the woods. And they're like, okay.
But you're like 10 feet tall, dude. You're going to stand
up. Yeah. So I'm out there putting face paint on. And back in the old days where we had the green and the BDUs, and we hit the woods. And I had a Gal 5. We had the Miles gear, all that kind of stuff. And we go through and we got to the OP. We got detected on the way out, had a firefight, lost one guy, wasn't me. And we ended our way out. And this goes on for a while. And then pretty soon they're letting me lead. And pretty soon I'm the one that's in charge and I'm the one that's directing everything that's going out in the field, even small team tactics type stuff.
I know a lot of those guys personally, they didn't just hand that to you.
No, they did not. That was a blast, man. That was so much fun. And then that was the first summer I was there, first spring and summer. So I had a lot of time to develop a relationship and, more importantly, trust with the guys I was leading. And winter hits, it is so freaking cold in upstate New York, and you get that lake effect snow. It snows 72 inches a year there. And I remember Colonel Shaq Beauchesne was our squadron commander, great man. He's got great stories too. But he goes, hey, the 15th ASOS out at Kuwait, we knew they were massing troops for Iraq. They need an augmentation team. Does anybody want to volunteer? And man, I'm from Mississippi. It's been 14 below for 2 weeks in a row. I was like, wait, sand's warm and fun. So I put up my hand. And the thing is, I hear commotion. As soon as I put up my hand, I look behind me because all the officers sat in the front row. And everyone in my flight was like,
they're going with you.
Yep. So I got to pick my team, which is awesome. And then I got to pick 6 members and we were off to the races out to Iraq. And when we got there, I was going to be assigned to the DTAC, I was disappointed because it's more of a admin function, but you're on the radios all the time. It turned out to be the most amazing, and I had the most responsibility maybe in the entire 3rd Infantry Division. It's Division Tactical Command Post, more or less. And their job is work 10 kilometers behind the front line the entire time. So 2nd Brigade, I believe it was 2nd Brigade, that was first out the chute. They fought for a day and a half, and when they ran out of beans and bullets and fuel, you do what it's called a passage of lines, where the 3rd Infantry or the 3rd Brigade was behind everyone, not shooting, not anything, just keeping up. And then 2nd Brigade more or less steps aside, 3rd Brigade goes, so we just fall in right behind 3rd Brigade and continue to fight. Most of us in the DTAC, we didn't sleep for 4 days. Maybe catch a nap here and there, but that was it, because you're constantly fighting. And at the time, you know, doctrinally, we fight with an ASOC, Air Support Operations Center. So a JTAC will get on the Joint Air Request Net, send a request to the ASOC. ASOC's got 6 or 7 folks in there that are have the complete air picture. They know exactly what's in the air at the time. They've got their air tasking order in their hands, and they're the ones that assign air to the, all these requests for close air support. The ASOC wasn't ready to go, so they got left behind. So the ASOC was my Humvee. Had my driver, who was JTAC qualified, Zeke, and myself. And I had SATCOM radio, I had UHF radio, I had VHF radio, and I had HF. And I had VHF in my right ear, I had UHF in my left ear, and I had the SATCOM radio turned all the way up on a speaker so I could hear them. And what we did was just move the cast stack over our nugget, and I would update them every 40 minutes, move to this position. And I had a huge grease board, not a grease board, it was a huge notebook, and I had one of those tough books for a computer.
And for the crowd, which Humvee usually gets shot at first in a convoy?
It's the one with all the antennas hanging out of it. And we had
six. And if y'all miss that, that's the one Rip was sitting in.
By the way, we're in a soft skin Humvee with armor.
Yep. You just sit on sandbags?
We had sandbags, and we had some extra sappy plates that we taped to the doors.
We did that, and we put our plates on our exposed rib cage side. Yeah.
Yep.
Good times.
Yeah. And then what we would do is that my JTACs would radio via the SATCOM, and actually I said UHF, actually VHF. We didn't have we had FM. And then I would clear fires with the Army side on the fires frequency to make sure that no friendlies were in that area. Once they greened it up, I would go to the CAS stack and say, I need you to contact this JTAC on this frequency. And if I had a 9-line, I'd pass it to them. And this is all while driving 50 miles an hour across the desert.
The theme of elation and panic, is there one mission that stands out that kind of brackets that discussion?
Oh, yeah. This was March 25th. We had rage for 4 days straight, and we got to about 25 kilometers south of Karbala, which is a city south of Baghdad. And we were about to squeeze the entire division through about 3 kilometers of land between a lake and a dam and the city. And we didn't have good battle damage assessment from the Air Force on how much artillery had been attrited. We devised a game plan for the 3-7 CAV, which was assigned to the 3rd Infantry Division, which all of my folks were assigned to. Now, I don't know if you know the 3-7 CAV's history. You may, because that was Custer's division.
I might know a little bit about it. Was this where Schropp was thrown into? Was Schropp in that one?
Yeah, Schropp and Keehan were in that one.
Yep, Schropp ended up being my JTAC a little bit later in that one.
Yep, great American. But a little history on 3-7 CAV. They were with Custer and Little Big Horn when they circled up the wagons, got completely decimated. And then again, and I don't know if you've seen read the book, We Were Soldiers Once. It was about the 3rd Air CAV Regiment in Vietnam. They also got the crap kicked out of them there. That was the unit. And I gotta wish I had more time because there was a great speech that the CAV commander gave before the push. He more or less said, there's one important guy in the room, and he ported to the Air Force guy. And it was Keehan of Shropshire, saying, these guys are going to save our ass. And guess what? In this story, I'll tell you, this is a great story of how they did. 25 March, the forecast was for thunderstorms. It's horrible. I worked for directly for the deputy commander of maneuver, which is a 1-star position, and the commander was then Brigadier General Lloyd Austin, who later became Secretary of Defense. I worked directly for him. In fact, he stood over my shoulder all the time when I was talking on the radios, listening to everything I was doing. So during the weather brief, he turns to me and goes, hey, Rip, are you going to be able to operate in this? And I was like, I told him there was risk. We usually want to drop GPS weapons into the wind and not thunderstorm gust winds, but we would be there for him if needed. So the plan was for the 3-7 CAV to siege 2 bridgeheads that were south of Karbala that crossed the Euphrates. We wanted the Iraqis to think that we're taking the entire division and moving it north of the Euphrates and joining the MEF, the Marines, that were on the north side, and then push to Baghdad. in order to present them a choke point, the Iraqis, to pinpoint their artillery on in order to get their location via the Q-36 radar and then go drop bombs on it or use our own MLRS or artillery to take them out. So more or less, we're taking the 3-7 Cav and their bait, and my guys are with them. So they take these bridgeheads. I am in a tent about three times as big as your office, and the wind is howling outside, and someone comes in and goes, dude, you will not believe what it looks like outside. So I pause from the radios, take my headset off, and I walk outside, and man, it looked like a Martian landscape. It was red. It was raining mud. At times, you can see 3 meters in front of your face. It was that bad. So I'm like, wow, how the hell are we going to do this? So we go back in, and they seize these bridges, and then they start taking fire. And that's when Saddam's Fedayeen, with technical vehicles and on foot, they just started coming out of the sand. The 3-7 Cav is not completely unprotected. They're all in Bradley Flighton vehicles and 113s, which is all armor. So they're buttoned up, but they're still very vulnerable. And so Keyan, myself, and Shropshire, we go on freak, and I was like, boys, kind of got an idea. And I think Keyan was airing to that idea as well. I think him and Shrop had already been talking, because we know what the target location area is on our Falcon View imagery on our computers. How about we just start picking out points and then buffer them a little bit for mom and pop and start dropping bombs just on points? And I was like, I think that would be a great idea. And so what we did was we took our danger close numbers, added them to a very, I would say, a medium buffer, and then we started dropping bombs. And I tell you what, back to that fear, intrepidness, if you will, that first bomb, I was on the radio, and weapon away, 45 seconds. That was the longest 45 seconds of my life, because we were doing something that hadn't really been tested at Nellis. It was a 2,000-pound bomb because a B-1 showed up. I will never forget the radio call. It was, she said, this is Bone 01. I got 36,000 pounds of hate. Where do you want it? And I was like, how about we just start with 2,000 first?
Yeah.
And then Vance, I think Advance 4-2 was Shropshire's call sign. So as soon as it timed out, I was like, Advance 4-2 status, and he didn't come back on the radio. And I give it like 3 or 4 seconds, Advance 4-2 status, nothing. And I didn't have to do it a second time because he came back on the radio. He goes, hey, man, it got really quiet. And the reason he didn't answer me, because he was outside his 113 trying to listen for the bomb and see where it hit and try to course it. He goes, man, I think it was perfect. So we just started slowly bringing him in. And yeah, that night was crazy. We didn't sleep that night. The army comms were down. So the Charlie troop commander who was in charge of the bridge siege was talking on the JARN, our network, to his boss, trying to get info and intel. But we did that all night, man. And for their efforts, for Keyhan and Shropshire's efforts that night, got silver stars out of that.
Yep, 2 of the 5. From Iraq, JTACs, who received silver stars.
Yep.
What you guys don't see is showing Rip a picture of those guys he's just talking about that I got on my phone, because yep, I know them as well.
Good dudes, man.
Big stuff, man. I don't want to cut this portion short because it's so worthy. Leadership lessons in there with elation, fear, humility, panic, all that stuff. But just for the audience's time of useful consciousness, post-ALO, he jumped back in. What happened after that? Jumped back into the jet.
Yeah, I jump back into the jet, I go back to Shaw Air Force Base, quickly go through a 4-shift flight lead upgrade, and then immediately into an instructor pilot upgrade. And again, being humble, my first instructor pilot upgrade ride is basic fire maneuvering, is offensive BFM. And my weapons officer at the time, when we got back, I debrief it. It was a ride. RJ Seymour was my weapons officer. And he goes, Rip, you know what, dude? I'm on the fence. I can pass you and you can continue on. I think you'll be fine. And, but I was like thinking, I was like, man, this is the last time that I will be able to fly with an IP and get all the nuggets I need to teach young kids how to fly or how to employ a weapon system. So I sucked it up and I said, dude, let's do it again. By the way, that was the very first F-16 upgrade ride that I had ever hooked. And the only one in the F-16 ever.
Let's talk taking pressure and then taking humility, because you're about teaching the next folks, right?
Yeah.
And you're flying with the expert if you're flying with a weapons officer. So yeah, I know there's more in that career. So stay at Shaw. Anything after that? What was next?
Shaw, then I went to Korea for a year and a half. There was a certain series of events that led me to separate from the Air Force and join the detachment at Shaw Air Force Base. Best move of my entire life. I was a reservist at Shaw from 08 until 2017. I think I deployed during that 9-year stint 6 times.
Did you ever go to Libya?
Oh yeah.
I don't want to watch over that.
Good lead in.
Yeah.
I tell you what, Libya was a hoot. This is back in 2012. This all started off with, we were going to Red Flag. We were on an airplane, the 77 Fighter Squadron. We get to Nellis. Someone gets on the aircraft, says, don't get off the airplane, because all this was going down. And so they get back on the airplane. They say, yeah, we're going to fuel it. You guys are going back to Shaw. And the 55th Fighter Squadron that we were supposed to rip out for weapons school support, they stayed behind. And they were next on the, I can't remember what it was called at the time, but they were next in the bucket to go. But this was at the very end of our bucket, and they tagged us to go. So, folks, if you don't think 72 hours is a thing, as soon as we got to the ground on Shaw Air Force Base, 72 hours, we had wheels in the well going to Italy to fight Operation Unified Protector.
Jordan. Oh, it's the thing.
Or not Jordan, but...
We'll practice in November. Hang on for that one. But yeah.
We take our jets. I'm the deployed DO there, so I'm flying at night. At first, NATO was leading this, and it wasn't really United States Air Force leadership. We were participating with NATO being the lead, and they were very shy about using wild weasels to drop bombs. And our leadership, I think, because of political reasons, did not want us participating in anything that the French were doing, per se. This was more important to NATO, mostly the Brits, and a lot of the French, because this is where they got their fuel. We finally convinced the CAOC that if we could find air defenses that had not been hit yet, that we could drop our weapons at the end of the vol. And our SCOW was, we had one high-speed anti-radiation missile on there for shooting SAMs, and then we had a Bru 57 smart rack with two GPS-guided 500-pound weapons, GPU 38s, on the left wing. So we would drop our 38s at the end of the bowl, different targets, and ended up, I think, dropping 52 munitions in about 6 months there. It was awesome.
Slightly impressive.
Yeah, it was fun.
Wow, dude. In their command tours, I know it came up in that, and it's about the Viper. Moving from some of the tactical stuff quickly into mentorship, leadership. You've heard me say mentorship and leadership knows no rank, position, or status in there. What's one leadership lesson that you wish every airman would take to heart, no matter rank, no matter position?
I'm going to roll it back to my days as an ALO. So I think this is where my ALO tour was such a blessing to me in so many ways. It was something I fought up front. And then I just finally said, you know what? I'm just going to go blossom where I'm planted. So I guess that's my first for airmen. You know, you may get an assignment or get put somewhere where you don't want to be. But I tell you what, if you just take it and make it your own, learn as much as you can about the job and try to be the best you can, things will be good. You're going to have leadership, or supervisors are going to see you excel, and they're going to take care of you. Your peers are going to take care of you. So I would say blossom where you're planted, no matter where you end up. Second one is, this may be one of the proudest moments of my Air Force career. And I think that's why I look back on that time as an air liaison officer. I wasn't even flying F-16s. And I would say that 2 years was probably the best 2 years of my career, because you got to really lead. And for a young kid that's a captain, fighter pilot, we just don't get a chance to lead like that ever. We're flight commanders at the senior captain, young major time frame, but you're managing your peers at that point. You're not really leading. You're just making sure that they've got all their squares filled and they're getting all their check rides done on times. OPB is done, blah, blah, blah. Throwing yourself into something that you're completely, maybe not completely uncomfortable with, but completely, a complete unknown, to say, that. Throwing yourself in with a bunch of 24 NCOs and airmen that have gone through an extensive tech school that they are insanely proud of when they get their beret. That's the pinnacle of their training, is they got their beret, they are tack peeps. And at the time, the officers, we didn't wear the beret because respected that. We would wear our boonie hat or our normal, just, I can't remember what kind of hat it was, but what you called it, but the camouflage hat with rank, that's what we used. So this was between Iraq and Afghanistan. So once I got done with Iraq in June, I turned around and went to Afghanistan with the 10th Mountain, volunteered to go to the, because I wanted to go with the guys again to Afghanistan with the 10th Mountain with the entire flight that time. But I remember Roman Lopez, he was very respected. He wanted to go. I think he ended up being a Special Forces TACP. And those are the elite, man. They only take the best. And I remember he came and knocked on the door, because I'm the full-up flight commander by then, Pinballs, now an ADO. He goes, "Hey, sir, we got the meeting." And I was like, "Oh, Lord, what did I miss?" So I'm grabbing my notebook and I'm coming out, and the entire room is empty. They go, "No, sir, we're going to have it outside. It's a nice day." I'm like, "Okay." So I walk outside and everyone's standing there, and I'm starting to read through my notes and go, "Hold on, sir." And they're laughing. And Roman says, "Hey, we know that you don't wear the beret out of respect for us, but I think you've earned it. We all do." And when you get there, you get to choose a TACP that's kind of like your guy, right? And Jeff Mack was mine. He was the sharpest guy out there. He ended up going to OTS. And Mac had about the same nugget as me, and he takes his beret off. Is it?
Wow. That's the one that's been sitting in your office all this time, isn't it?
Yep.
That's huge, man. That's huge. What you guys can't see is that Rip has the biggest heart in the world, and we all appreciate it. Similar, but changing gears a little bit, we'll do two sides of this question. What's one thing that's changed in the Air Force over the course of your career that you think made us better?
Wow. In what respect? Say,
I have no parameters on the question. It can be airmen, it can be training, it can be the jets, it can be structure, it can be anything.
I don't know. That's a tough one,
isn't it? Hold on to that for a second. What's made us worse? Don't worry, you're retiring.
I would say that's a tough one too, Buster. It's made us worse. I know that right now that we have got a lot of talent in the 06 pool that is leaving. Why, I don't know. I know that I would love to keep going, but I'm on my mandatory separation date. I've only got 30 years before I'd have to go. And tell you the truth, I would have served out till 30, but I was getting out of the way of other 06s on this base so they could take over.
I like what you did there. I hope they're listening.
One of them already retired ahead of me.
So. Yeah, I know.
There goes that. I don't know. I would have to think on that one, Custer. That's a million-dollar question right there, man.
Hey, we'll leave it open. We'll leave it open for discussion through your retirement here this week. We'll leave it open to discussion, maybe a little philosophical for our airmen of what's made it better, what's made it worse. What have you done to make it better or worse in that realm? You specifically, that's Big A airmen throughout.
Before we get into that, you know, my story on the 20th ASOS and how I got my beret, we were going somewhere with that and I forgot to close it up. But you were talking about lessons for airmen.
Yeah.
One, blossom where you're planted. Two, and this is what I did, is I just showed up, man. Show up. Show up every day. Show up ready. Study. I had no idea what, I mean, the TACPs have got an entire set of regulations that I was not familiar with. I was... Joint Fires Pub was about as much as I knew. And then you go in and you be humble. And mentorship goes two ways. It goes down, it goes up. And most of mine, when I was at the 20th ASOS, it was from the airman level up to me. And you just show up and sincerely care, sincerely participate. Dude, they're going to make sure you're good to go. They will literally fight for you. Which they did, not once, but twice. So there you have it. Show up, be humble, be prepared.
Show up, care, be humbled,
integrity.
As you hit in there.
100%.
Again, I don't want to cut this short because there's so much we could talk about, but just for the crowd, what's next?
Next is going to be trying to integrate with my family on a full-time basis, because you're gone away from home a lot with the job. But man, I'm already a pilot for Delta Airlines, so I'm a first officer. I'm going to continue that as my next career. It's a great company. It's a great company to work for. They have a really good hiring process, so the folks that you fly with are much like myself, plus or minus, of course. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to getting back in touch with my family. I'm looking forward to spending more time with my daughter, because she's the only one left in the house anymore. Maybe coach some soccer. I don't know. Wake up, draw a paycheck for sipping coffee. Sounds pretty awesome.
Sounds awesome. See you at deer camp too, by the way.
That's right.
We're good buds, as the crowd can hear there. All right, so here's the last question I've got for you. What are you going to miss the most?
Yeah, that's easy. I'm going to miss the people in this room. I'm going to miss the people in this office. Some guys down there at the squadron. Miss the commanders. I'm going to miss all the folks of the 42nd Powder Wing. And I'm speaking to all the folks out there. Without you guys, there is no mission. It just doesn't get done. I will tell you that this space is special. And it's not because we got F-16s. It's not because we have tenants. It's not because we own our airfield. Yada, yada. It's the folk that are a part of this wing and make up this wing. And you guys are amazing. And I've been here for 4 years. And you guys have made it great. Great 4 years, and I really appreciate you guys. And I've said it once, I'll say it again. You got to be ready. The call is going to be there in a minimal amount of time. You're going to be expected to go out the door. So continue to support each other, especially with this possible 180 coming up, and pump each other up. Make sure you're ready. Hold each other accountable and enjoy that time together. I just want to say thanks one more time. It's been an honor and a privilege to work for you. And if you guys ever need anything, I live in Noonan, south of Georgia or south of Atlanta. Come on, come by. I'll have plenty of whiskey and beer.
Rip, we're honored to have served with you. You're a friend, you're a mentor, you're a leader. You're a steadfast, foundational part of this wing. And we're going to miss you a lot. And yeah.
Appreciate that, brother.
All right.
Enjoyed it.
That's what we got.
That about wraps it up for this episode. If you'd like more content from the 42nd Fighter Wing, be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram. We'll see you next time on the Mako Minute.